You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
You're listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, in conversation with Joe Dombrowski. After riding the Giro d'Italia earlier this year, Joe spent a few days on holiday in London, and he was kind enough one evening to pop down to the Rafa Cycle Club in Spitalfields to talk to me, Richard Moore, in front of what was quite a big audience. I should point out that the reference to Brexit and the European Football Championships at the start owe to the timing of the event. In fact, it was the night of the Brexit vote. Joe is now riding his second Grand Tour of the year, the Vuelta, so we thought it would be a good time to release this wide-ranging conversation, in which he covers his start in cycling and rapid progression, his first time racing in Europe, his difficulties with his first pro team, Team Sky, his dream teammates, and what Vasyl Kiryenka watches on YouTube.
So, here we are. Thank you very much, everybody, for... Well, thank you for... acting so quickly to get tickets, because I think tickets went extremely quickly. You're very big in London, Joe.
Huge in London.
A cult hero. So you've escaped the English thugs in Nice. Not all of them, obviously, but some of the English fans in Nice were causing a bit of trouble the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, they've been a bit rowdy down there. I think, actually, they had to shut down a couple bars because...
Is that not just your post-Giro sort of winding down?
Yeah, I might have had a thing to do with that as well.
We'll get on to that, because you hinted at that earlier. But so you've come over for our wonderful weather, and I thought we could start off with Brexit tonight. I don't know if you're, I don't know if you've been following the whole Brexit thing.
I didn't vote.
Silence.
I don't know if I'm allowed to vote, but
no, you're not allowed to vote. No.
Okay.
No, let's be clear about that. Don't even try.
All
okay.
Right.
You've got Trump. You know, we've got Brexit. It's fine. Now listen, Joe.
Is Trump going to win?
Is Trump going to win?
Yeah.
Well, you tell us.
I don't know. I'm in Europe so much, I just lose contact.
You were a bit of a Trump fan when I spoke to you a few months ago.
Was I? I was not a Trump fan.
You seemed intrigued by him.
He's intriguing, that's for sure. But, yeah, I don't know if we can have him as president.
He's we'll a big Joe Dombrowski fan, I believe.
Yeah.
Naturally. Donald Trump was involved in cycling in the U.S. before you were born.
Yeah. Tour de Trump.
Tour de Trump. Yeah.
Was that actually Donald Trump?
That was Donald Trump.
Really?
Yeah, that was Donald Trump.
Yeah, and you know that's actually my area, Virginia, West Virginia, East Coast. I think it started up in Delaware and then made its way down through Virginia, West Virginia, maybe North Carolina. There was Tour de Pont and Tour de Trump.
Mm.
Well,
anyway,
I'd like to bring that back, actually.
Yeah, we'll get on to some serious questions in a moment. Joe's become a bit of a cult figure this year for cycling podcast listeners because. He was featured in an episode, a Friends special we did earlier in the year in Nice with Ian Boswell and Larry Warbass, the Young Americans, which was a very well-received episode produced by Tom Wally, who's here tonight as well. And then Tom also produced Joe's diary at the Giro, which Joe was kind enough to sort of record bits every day in conversation with people, just behind-the-scenes stuff, interviewed your parents at the end, which was cool. And that was all very well received, so Joe has been great for us on the podcast this year. We were also lucky having Joe at the Giro because he rode a really outstanding Giro. He's a climber, and he seemed to get stronger and better as the race went on, and happier. It was really weird.
Yeah.
His riders at the...
I was not so happy in the crosswinds up in Holland.
No, but you know...
You know, week three when we hit the real mountains, then...
You see, generally you see guys getting broken down by a stage race like that, not just the riders, but the staff as well. You know, everyone's kind of broken in the final week, but you were just seemed to be getting better and better. We'll get onto that as well. Let's go right back to the start, Joe, because this is something you talked about in the Young Americans episode, where you were quite late to cycling. As we learned in your diary, your parents are both aerospace engineers. Unusual,
yeah.
For a cyclist. How did you get into road cycling?
Well, I actually started out riding and racing mountain bikes was my first thing. And I guess it started, I was in high school and just had some friends that rode mountain bikes. And I would go out on the weekends with them and just, you know, a lot of times we'd take like a road trip on the weekend and ride different trails each time. And a few of my friends raced, and I did my first race. Yeah, I was probably about 16. There's this series. It's still going. Actually, I'm headed home in a bit, and I'm thinking I might jump in and do one. It's called the Wednesdays at Wakefield, and it's like a midweek every Wednesday night, about an hour long mountain bike race. And I did that, and I was hooked. I think I finished third in the first one, and yeah, it was super fun. And my first couple years racing, it was mostly just on the mountain bike, and then I also picked up cyclocross in the fall. And it wasn't until I was about 18, 19 that I started racing on the road.
So pretty late. Was it something, I mean, did you do other sports? Could you tell that you had a talent for it?
I did a lot of sports with no validation that I had any talent for anything.
Well, cyclists often, maybe hand-eye coordination is not their thing. Whereas, you've got the engine. Was that the case for you, that you realized you had this talent?
Well, yeah. I mean, I did play lacrosse. I played basketball. Did baseball. So I was maybe lacking a little bit in the hand-eye coordination department. But I also ran cross country and swam, and I wasn't really good at that either. So
strange.
Yeah.
And then you pretty rapidly sort of moved into an organized racing setup. Quite quickly, you became part of the Lance Armstrong, Livestrong sort of setup, which was a development team run by Axel Merckx. How did that come about?
Well, in my hometown, there's actually a guy, he's probably in his mid-40s now, and he lived in Austin in, I guess it would have been mid-90s, late 90s. And at the time, Austin, Texas was kind of a hub of American riders. Kevin Livingston was there, Chan McRae, obviously Lance Armstrong. And my friend Chris, he was never a professional rider, but he was a good racer, and he's quite good friends with all those guys. And it was my first season really racing on the road, and I had started riding like the group rides with the local shop team. And there's one race in particular that was it's one of the bigger races in the Mid-Atlantic. And I won it pretty unexpectedly. And that sort of prompted my friend Chris to send an email to Bart Nags, who was more or less the manager of, he managed, U.S. Postal Discovery. And then when Lance came back, he started the Trek Livestrong team. And it was the same management company that ran them both. So Chris emailed Bart and just said, hey, there's this kid from town, and seems like he's really good, and I don't know how you guys go about recruiting riders, but maybe just keep an eye out for him. And it was a total long shot, and I didn't think that anything would become of it. But then a few days later, I had an email from Axel Merckx in my inbox, and he was asking if I would be interested in guest riding with them later in the year, because they were actually it was, I think, the second year that Trek Livestrong had been around, and they had guys going up to World Tour teams as stagiaires, so they were short on riders. And they asked me if I wanted to do Tour of Utah with them, and obviously I said yes. And I went, and I did the race, and it went pretty well. And at the end of the week, Axel asked me if I wanted to come to the team next year, and that they would be happy to have me. So I did that, and basically, all within that year, 2010, somehow I went from, I started out racing Cat 5, which is, I don't know what the category system is in the UK, but
it doesn't sound very good.
No, it's like you're like a total Fred. I went from racing Cat 5 to racing with Axel's development team by the end of the year. So it was a very fast ascent. And then I did 2 years with them. And then I guess I was probably 20, 21, and then I went to Sky.
Well, we'll get on to that. But the what's quite interesting is, you started quite late, so you maybe didn't develop a lot of you obviously had the engine, as mentioned mm-hmm. a couple of times, but you didn't maybe develop the skills. Tell us about the first time you went to Europe to race.
Yeah, my first race in Europe was in 2011, Ronde Lizard, and it's one of the bigger under 23 races on the calendar, and it's I think 3 or 4 days. It's always in the Pyrenees, and it's sort of like a, if you're familiar with Route du Sud, which is one of the smaller races before the Tour de France, it's sort of like a under 23 version of that. And I went there with Axel's team, and yeah, it was my first time racing in Europe. And I remember, I think it was 3 or 4 stages, and the first 2 days were totally flat, and then the last 2 days were pretty hard mountain days. And I mean, I was scared for my life. Like, I sat last wheel the entire first 2 days because, you know, just going around all these roundabouts and all this road furniture and guys bunny hopping up on the sidewalk, and like, I just...
Because this doesn't really exist in the US.
No.
The roads are not like that.
No, we have big roads, and in general, the level of racing in the US in terms of bike handling and peloton skills is much lower. So it was a traumatic experience. But somehow I didn't crash. I didn't lose time, finished in the bunch every day. I was super nervous, and I couldn't do anything but basically sit at the back. You know, I mean, the commissaire cart saw a lot of me. But then we hit the mountains. I think we, stage three finished at Super Bagnères. And then stage four, the last day, was it was like 3 or 4 big Cat 1 HC type climbs. And I think second on the uphill finish. Kenny Elissonde won the stage. He's now riding for FDJ, really petite French climber. And he ended up winning the overall, and I think I was second overall and won the KOM jersey. So it was, I think in a way, Axel was really impressed because he's like, this kid's never raced in Europe, and now he's almost won his first race in Europe. But at the same time, especially... you know, his view from the team car, seeing me sitting at the back all day because I couldn't handle the peloton. I think he thought, this kid's got a lot to learn.
A raw talent. I mean, we've seen you. We've got a stage from the Tour of Switzerland up there, Tour of Switzerland last week, and Joe went from the Giro there and rode exceptionally well. I think we're going to see him ripping it up. You were in the Rafa Cafe in Soho yesterday, and it came up on the screen.
Yeah. Quite surreal. I walked in and I was on TV.
You know, we see you now on these big, you know, Alpine style climbs. What was, again, different to the US? What was your impression? Because obviously they're perfectly suited to your ability. You've shown that you can handle them very well, but that race, you know, in the Pyrenees, what was your impression of these kind of monster mountains?
Yeah, it was, I mean, I took in a lot in those 4 days, you know, from the first two flat days, basically thinking like, I can't do this. I have no interest in this, to then riding so well at the end. You know, we don't really have so many climbs like that in the States in most of the races. And I could just see, you know, straight away that it really suited me really well.
So you went home thinking, I can do this, but I'm not sure I can do it all.
Yeah.
There are certainly challenge things I have to learn.
Right.
But you know, your career went, it was a very sort of very sharply upward trajectory. It was only a year later that you were back in Europe and you won the baby Giro, which is mm-hmm. the under 27, isn't it?
Under 27, yeah.
Giro, effectively. You beat Fabio Aru there, who's mm-hmm. who's not done too badly. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, so in 2011, that was the year that I first went to Europe, and I did two trips. The first one with Axel's team, and the second one with the national team. And then the second trip was my first time racing with the U.S. national team because they didn't know who I was before because I was pretty anonymous. And then their big goal for 2012 was the Baby Giro and Tour de l'Avenir, which is sort of the two. The Baby Giro has since sort of fallen off the calendar, I think, due to financial issues. But that and Tour de l'Avenir are kind of the premier stage races for amateur riders. And they took me there, and I'd raced in Italy before, the year before, with the national team at Val d'Aosta, and I won a stage there, and I was second overall, and so I felt like I could do a good ride at the Baby Giro. And it was also, I had just done with Axel's team Tour of California, and I was in, I think, third or fourth on the uphill finish to Mount Baldy, which was sort of like the first time that I think a lot of people first saw me, you know, up there with Horner and Hayesink and whoever else. So I thought I had a good shot, and it was a pretty complete race. Like, we had some big mountain stages, flat stages, time trial, day on Strada Bianchi, so a bit of everything. And I first took the pink jersey on stage four to Terminillo. We went up and then finished on the downhill. And then the next day, stage five, we had a stage on the Strada Bianchi. And it's sort of like Roubaix in that, you know, in the amateurs, we only have one team card normally. And in racing over the gravel like that, a lot of times the team car's quite a ways behind because the commissaire will basically do like a barrage so that riders that are dropped can't use the cars to come back. So if you don't have a teammate in the front, then you're basically isolated and you rely on neutral support. And I was in the front group with about 10K to go, and I had a flat and no teammates around. So I waited 2 minutes for a wheel, and my team car finally got there, and I had lost the jersey that day because I think I ended up losing 2.5 minutes. And it's kind of funny to look at the results of the race now, because a lot of us are now professional riders, and you know, you see names pop up, and it was Ilner Zakarin took the pink jersey, who's now riding for Katusha. And then we had some more transitional stages. He kept the jersey until stage nine, where we had this, honestly, I don't know if I've ever done a stage this big, even as a World Tour rider. I mean, even like in the Giro, we had the Queen stage in the Dolomites, and it wasn't as big as it was. I think we had like 5,400 meters of climbing, five big climbs, and we finished on the Gavia. And I was like 2.5 minutes out of the jersey, and the main rival was Fabio Aru, and I was maybe like 30, 40 seconds down on him. And the team, I was with the national team, and it was with some of my friends who are based with me in Nice now, Ian Boswell and Larry Warbass were with me at the race as well. And I thought like, okay, I think I'm the strongest climber here, but to make up that deficit, I'm just going to have to go from bottom of the Gavia. So we got to the bottom. There's maybe 20 guys still left. Larry took this massive 5-minute pull, and I just went, and I won the stage. Took back the jersey. I think Aru finished like maybe a minute behind and was second overall. And then, I mean, it was such a big day. Like, third or fourth place was probably 5 minutes down. Like, it was epic.
So that was 2012, and then that obviously put you on the radar of a lot of teams. I think there were a lot of teams. There was a bit of a Joe Dombrowski auction going on, I think, for 2013, and you turned pro with Team Sky. Mm-hmm. Which was quite an unusual choice for an American rider. You and Ian Boswell joined Team Sky. Why Team Sky?
Well, I think looking at it from what I knew then, you know, as a GC oriented rider climber, I sort of saw, I mean, Sky for that is the best team in the world, and I wanted to go to the best team. And I thought, you know, the support infrastructure that they had there, it would be the best place for me to develop. And also, it was kind of a package deal where myself and Ian could go together, because I think they knew that either one of us on our own, it would have been a pretty big struggle. Like, you know, they insisted basically that we live in Nice, which at the time, there wasn't any Americans there. It was at one point, you know, 10, 15 years ago, sort of a hub like Girona is now, and now we have a group of Americans there, but they wanted us to move there, and I think they thought that if we did it just totally on our own, that it would have been a real struggle. And just, you know, having a friend at the team obviously helps.
What are Sky's techniques for wooing a rider like you? What do they do? Zay Brailsford take out for dinner? Bradley Wiggins take out for beer? How did it
I think it's mostly just a big paycheck.
What was the deduction? Oh, that's so disappointing. But you joined Team Sky, and your first race for Team Sky was a Tour of Oman. I was there, and we it was the first time I'd met you, and we chatted one night, and you were very, you know, open about how daunting it was to step up that level, and to, you know, you were still getting to grips with some of those challenges about riding in a bunch, and you know, the you know sort of standing your ground there, and here you were riding for Team Sky with Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome, both in that team, you know, Tour de France defending champion and the favorite for that year. What was that like?
Yeah, it was kind of, as you said, I think daunting is pretty accurate. You know, Oman was, in a way, it was like an easy place to start. At the time, it didn't seem like that, but, you know, looking at it now, it's like for the most part, there's not too much wind. It's mostly big desert highway roads. It's pretty easy to get to the front if you need to be the front. It's February, so it's pretty low stress still. But yeah, even that was a big step up, you know, in the level of racing. And also the team we had there, you know, it was a pretty elite company. Like you said, I think Chris and Brad were there, Richie Porte, I think Kirienka, Kenyuk, Canise. Yeah, it was definitely a hit. And that was the year, actually, that Brad was going for the Giro. And, you know, I think expectations for me at Sky were pretty high coming in because of what I had done as an amateur. And I was basically, from the first training camp in December, sort of roped into that Giro squad. And looking at it now, I think it was a little bit, maybe on their part, I think they overestimated what I was capable of a little bit, because the plan was basically for me to race with the team that would do the Giro. It was a big goal that Brad could go and win the Giro, and I was meant to be like his last man or second to last man in the mountains. As a first year Neo Pro, you know, 20, 21 years old, that's a pretty big ask.
Although the way things turned out, you would have been redundant in that role because he didn't make it as far as the mountains. How were Wiggins and Froome as teammates? How did they make you feel welcome? Did you know? Could you figure them out?
Yeah, I mean, that was. I think at that point there was a fair bit of drama between the two of them. I think a lot of it was stirred up by the media.
Oh yeah, sure. Media's fault. It's always the media's fault.
It's those damn journalists. Yeah, and so, I mean, there was that, but yeah, to be honest, it was, maybe it didn't feel so welcoming, but I think a lot of that was just because I felt a bit out of place in the team, and it was a big step up, and I had just moved to Europe, and it was just so much to take in. But to be honest, everybody was really nice guys. I mean, you have different personalities, like, you've been around Brad, he's a bit of a different personality, but he's great. He's super funny and he's a good guy, and Chris as well. So overall I felt good there.
But you know, you didn't have an easy couple of years, health problems, mm-hmm. problem with your iliac artery, wasn't it? When did you first realize that there was something not quite right?
Well, it was about halfway through my first year with Sky. I can remember exactly when it was. We were doing a training camp based out of Nice, and it was just like five or six of us, and we were doing these long efforts up Col de Torini. It's like over an hour long climb, and I remember just like my left leg kind of feeling like it, almost like I had like a cramp in my calf, but it was strange, like kind of like numbness, not really a cramp, but it was just so hard to, like, you know, put a finger on it. And team car stopped at the top, and we got jackets, got ready to go down. And I told him, like, yeah, there's something going on with my left leg. I don't know what it is. Like, so, I mean, long story short, it started, I guess, June, July of my first year, and it wasn't until about a year later that we finally actually here in London, I think it's St. James Hospital, we got it diagnosed and figured out that I had a problem with my iliac artery, which is, it's somewhat common in cyclists. Generally, it's more in professional cyclists because more or less an overuse injury and takes a lot of time riding with in a hip flex position for it to happen. But basically the artery gets damaged over time and then you just have limited blood flow to one leg.
So you had that fixed and it was a successful operation, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you joined Cannondale. Is that a better environment for you? Is it somewhere you feel a bit more comfortable?
Yeah, I think for sure. You know, I guess firstly, it's an American team. It's hard to say what that means anymore in modern cycling. I think we have 16 different nationalities in the team. It's registered in the States, and there's a bit more American interest than there would be, you know, in other teams. And so that's nice because, you know, we spend a lot of time here racing in Europe, and if you can make it seem a bit more like you're at home, then I think that's good. I think, to be honest, I'd say it's sort of akin to, I don't necessarily buy into everything Malcolm Gladwell says, but I read one of his new books recently, and he talks basically, there's a bit in there, and he talks about high school valedictorians going to Ivy League schools. And it was just interesting for me to read because it really, I think, spoke to my experience in that, you know, he's basically saying, like, a lot of times you have somebody that's top in their class in high school and they want to go to Harvard or Yale or whatever. And they get there, they get in, get accepted, they go, and they get there. And a lot of times they find that, you know, they've gone from top of their class to maybe now they're in the bottom 25%. And a lot of times maybe they change their major, drop out, whatever. And then at the graduate level, maybe they don't. Rather than, you know, if they were in the top 10% of a class and they're getting their work published, but they're at this elite school, now they're maybe in the bottom half and nothing gets published. And basically, he was trying to make the argument that, you know, sometimes you're better off being sort of a bigger fish in a small pond. Mm. And I think, I'm not trying to say that Cannondale's not a good team, because I think we're a great team, but I think for a young rider like myself or neopros in general, that it can be easy going to a team like Sky to get a bit lost in the system, because, you know, it's a big step and they're focused on the biggest objectives. You know, they go to the Tour de France every year with more or less the best team. So I think looking at it now retrospectively, that if I could do it again, I probably wouldn't have gone there first. And I don't know that it's a great team for young guys. I think, you know, there's definitely riders that have their place there where it really makes sense. But I think looking at it retrospectively for me, going to a team like Cannondale off the bat actually would have been a better step.
Would you go back to Team Sky?
I don't know. Maybe.
Just scrolling back a little bit, you know, you turned pro over that winter 2012, 2013, and that was the autumn of discontent. That was the autumn of the Armstrong downfall, and mm-hmm. that must have been a huge story in the US. Your parents, who we heard from in the diary, sound like very sensible people. What were their thoughts about you going off to Europe to become a professional cyclist when the publicity around the sport at that time must have been pretty bad?
Right. I mean, there was a lot of negative press, and actually it bothered me a little bit because cycling was kind of in the limelight again in the US, but sort of for all the wrong reasons. And so everybody sort of that knows me as a cyclist back home, you know, ask you what you think about, like, oh, what do you think about the whole Lance ordeal? You know, like, what do you think the peloton's like now? And it felt like I was always having to like dispel doubt amongst, you know, people that knew me. And I didn't like that because it's like, I have no experience with any of that and never seen any of it. And it's like, well, I know the cycling that I'm in now that it's not a thing for me, so I can't really comment on it. But at the same time, it's like, I don't think it's fair that, I guess like it bothered me that everyone sort of doubted the sport because of something that had happened before. And I guess to answer your question in regards to my parents, I mean, I think they probably wouldn't have said anything just because they know that it would irk me a bit. But I think for sure my mom, you know, is concerned about like the environment I'm in and wanted me to be in a place where I wasn't, you know, going to be pushed into making bad decisions or anything like that. Which I think in the modern Peloton, you know, can we say the modern Peloton's 100% clean? No, like there's always people that are going to cheat. But I think for the most part, it's not like it was in the past where it's, you know, there's anything systematic or where, to be honest, I don't think that anyone really sees it anymore. And I think it's mostly individuals.
Have you ever, I mean, especially as you start to perform as you are, have you had people doubt you, question you?
I don't know that anyone's like come up to me and, you know, specifically said it. So I don't know. Maybe there's doubters out there. I guess I'd kind of take it as a compliment.
Ask some questions later. So Joe, you joined Cannondale, you rode your first Grand Tour, and you seem to be, you know, back on track. You were fit and you rode the Vuelta. You rode a pretty decent Vuelta. Mm-hmm. A lot of riders say that riding a Grand Tour, you come out of it a different rider. This sort of extra layer added, something just changes. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I think so, but I don't know that I really recognized it until I got to this year, because after the Vuelta, there isn't so much left. And all I did was Lombardia, which is just a one-day race. But, you know, I think, you know, people say that, and I think there's a lot of truth to that in terms of, you know, it's a big learning experience going through a three-week race, and you have to figure out how you can be efficient and save energy and get through the race. And I think also, like, physiologically speaking, just getting through a Grand Tour is kind of a big landmark step as a pro.
Well, let's move on to this year's Giro, because it was a sort of action-packed race for you. I mean, it started in Holland. You were a bit ill there. You had a bit of a cold for the first week or so, but that wasn't your time, you know, and you knew that the mountains were coming. You were riding in support of Rigoberto Urán, who ultimately kind of faded a little bit and didn't mount the challenge he wanted to mount. And as that happened, you sort of had a bit more of a free hand to play. And, you know, you started in that final week to show what you were capable of in the mountains. Tell us a little bit about stage 16, the day after the rest day. It was a very short explosive stage. And a group went clear on the climb. And you bridged across. And it contained Valverde, Nibali, all the big riders.
Right. I think it was maybe the most embarrassing moment of my Giro. So it was stage 16. We had just come off the rest day. A really short stage. And one of those days that's potentially really dangerous. And people always say it, but until you ride a Grand Tour, you don't really grasp it. But a lot of times, the rest days are kind of weird. And a lot of times the next day, if you don't ride enough or whatever, then you can be great or you can be really bad. And anyway, it was a short 120K stage and one of those days where it just really kicked off. And I guess I don't know if you can call it a breakaway if it's all the hitters up there. I think it's just the race. But there was about eight of us up the road, and I think everybody was in there. I mean, Nibali, Valverde. I think the only big GC names that were not there were Rigo and Esteban Chavez. And I saw it going and rode across because I was thinking, you know, if all these guys are up here, this could very well go to the line because no one's really misrepresented. And the type of stage it was, too, there's not really any flat, so it's hard to... I mean, you can put a big guy on the front and bring something back on the flat, but he's not going to outride Nibali on a climb. And so I was there, and I was in the break, and it was really a perfect scenario. The only thing not perfect, which ended up after everything sort of went into a downward spiral, was Rigo is behind. But anyway, I'm in this move, eight guys, and I've been told on the radio not to pull because I'm more or less the only rider that's not in GC. I think Nibali had his teammate, Tano Conger, but other than that, I was the only rider in there that didn't really belong there. So my directors on the radio, don't pull, don't do anything, just sit on. You know, you can win the stage. And everybody was pissed that I'm just sitting on. And to be honest, I don't really know why, because I would have thought, you know, somebody like Nibali with a teammate, he would put all his energy into putting as much time into Chavez and Uran behind. But anyway, I'm sitting on, and they're pretty unhappy that I'm not pulling. And so, you know, they kind of start to take me off the back a bit and let these gaps open up. And ultimately, it would have been a lot easier for me just to pull through. And you don't have to pull, per se, but just roll through and keep everyone happy and everything civilized. And we're going into basically the last climb, and we're on the flat, and we're flying, going 65-70k an hour. And Conger let a bit of a gap open up and then sprinted back on, and I missed the wheel. And I think, oh, shit, like, I just got dropped on the flat from the brake. So
was that deliberate, though? I mean, was he trying to take you out the back?
I think, yeah, he was not happy. Like, yeah, more or less, yes. Mm. And so here I am in no man's land, and we've gone from a really advantageous situation where I'm in the front, I can potentially win the stage. All the pressure behind is on Chavez's team to chase because I'm in the front, and they say, oh, well, Joe can win the stage, we don't have to ride. To now, Joe's been dropped on the flat, has to tell everybody on the radio, and now the team has better start riding because we're not going to win the stage, and Rigo's a minute behind. So, yeah, it was not good.
I think the TV cameras did capture your reaction, didn't they?
Yeah, I might have dropped a F-bomb on live TV.
But, you know, a learning experience. I think you said immediately afterwards that you would learn from it and maybe, you know, pretend later that your earpiece had fallen out your ear.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, ultimately, it's you're in the race, you're on the road, you see everything that's happening, and you get feedback from the director's car, but you can't. Sometimes you just have to decide for yourself. Like, that was a scenario where if I would have just pulled through and, you know, been a helper, then I think everyone would have been fine, and it would have been easier than jumping around at the back. You know, every time everybody opens a gap, you're sprinting back on. And especially for a rider like me, that's kind of the effort that'll kill me. So, you know, you learn that, and yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, in the Giro, especially later in the race, the last 10 days or so, the race really opened up with a lot of opportunities for me. And I was, I think, most of the mountain days later in the race, I was in the breakaway. And there was a number of times where I made mistakes that, you know, looking at it now, it's like, well, these are all learning opportunities. I probably learned more in the last half of the Giro than I have in my whole pro career.
Yeah, because you were, I think, third on that big stage with, you know, the final mountain stage, and you were very, very active and clearly one of the strongest riders in the race. What's it like to find yourself in that position? You know, you're at the Giro and you are a guy who, when the road goes up, you were clearly one of the strongest in the race. What does that feel like? I mean, we're not at the point yet, but in this climb, I think, you sat at the front and basically reduced that group to about the third, a third of the size it is now, guys like Van Garderen going out the back. What does it feel like?
Yeah, it was, you know, it's definitely good for my confidence. And I didn't know exactly what I was going to be capable of in the Giro. And the first good days I had were from the breakaway. And it was always days, for me, it's hard to get in breakaways that go on the flat because it's the breakaway thing is always, it's just a game, you know, like, basically, if three riders chip off the front super easy as soon as the neutral flag drops, the chance that breakaway is going to go to the line is like zero. And the Peloton knows that, and that's why three guys on three small teams chip away. Sprinters teams ride the front. We bring it back. It's super controlled. Whereas then you have days where maybe it's a flat start, but it's a lumpy finish. The sprinters teams aren't so confident that somebody like Kittle's going to make it over the last climbs, so they don't ride. So the break has a good chance, but it's very hard to get in because sometimes we'll go full gas for an hour and a half, and it's a little bit of a lottery because you can't go with every move for an hour and a half. And then there's the type of days that I can get in the break, which are not those days typically, when there's a climb early enough in the start that it's just the strongest guys that aren't in GC go up the road, and either you're strong enough or you're not. And the first days of the Giro where I started to ride really well, it was more or less that. So, you know, I had the confidence and showed that, you know, those days where you have, you know, maybe a guy like Visconti in the move, who's kind of more of a stage hunter in that type of Giro with a guy like Valverde on the team. I could be there with the strong guys, but I didn't know if I had the ability. There's a difference between that, where it's like, okay, these guys are strong, and that's a strong move. But then the next step from that is like, well, can you follow when you're in the GC group and it's down to 7-8 guys, and it's, you know, most everyone is just on their own. And I guess the first time I saw that, I think stage 14, we were in the Dolomites, and it was labeled as the queen stage of the race. And we went over Paso Giao, and I think at that point it was just 7 or 8 of us left in the group. And it was only, no one had teammates other than Nibali had Scarponi and Rigo had myself. And that, I guess, was the first time in the race. And it's a good confidence boost for sure when you think like, okay, the race is on. It's only the hitters up here. And, if you know, if I can climb with these guys and be comfortable, then I'm in a good spot.
So one thing I forgot to ask you about the day that you were in the move with Nibali Valverde, you mentioned in your audio diary that they were shouting and screaming at you. What were they saying, or could you understand what you followed?
I think it was expletives in a number of different languages, but
you got the gist of it.
I got the gist of it, yeah.
One other thing you said, and we'll open up to questions in a moment or two, but another thing you said in your audio diary was about what you do after a Grand Tour, and you know, the way to keep your form is to actually keep riding at the same sort of intensity. So what did you rode very well in Switzerland. What did you do after the Giro? Talk us through those 2 weeks.
Yeah, so basically, typically, if you finish a Grand Tour healthy and not super fatigued, then 2-3 weeks later, you can still be riding pretty good. And initially, Tour of Switzerland wasn't on my program, but we added it after the Giro because I had finished the Giro well, and they asked me, you know, what do you want to do? If you just want to take a break, that's fine, but if you want to do Swiss, then we can add that into the calendar. So I said yes, and basically the instructions were like, okay, don't get fat, and you need to keep riding maybe a little bit more than you think. So it sounds actually counterintuitive, but I rode for about 4 or 5 days after the Giro, between like 2.5 and 4.5 hours a day.
But was that hard to do mentally?
A little bit, because a lot of my friends were just off, and I wanted to just take off. But we did it a bit different, in that you have to think, in a Grand Tour, your homeostasis is 5-6 hours of racing a day, you know, a big turnover every day. And I mean, I don't know exactly why, but if you just stop, then it's like your body just goes a bit haywire. So the plan was basically to do 4 or 5 days and kind of gradually bring that down, and then have 2 days totally off or whatever. And basically, if I could just keep riding, watch the diet a little bit, and
no drinking beer.
I might have had a couple nights out between the Giro and Swiss.
So you're blaming these English fans for the
yeah, the I mean, you just have to join in on the fun.
Right, should we open up to some questions? Before, just finally, before we do, what year did you say you were going to win the Giro again?
What did we say, 2020?
2020, okay.
I got a bit of time.
Excellent. Anyone got any questions?
Can you give us some insight on the actual opinions in the peloton about disc brakes and whether it's seen as a good thing, a bad thing?
I think there's a pretty big spread on it. I would say if we were to vote yes or no, and everyone in the peloton said yes or no, I think we would actually get a no on them. I mean, I guess my personal take on it is that in the dry, I don't think that normal rim brakes are ever a problem. And in the wet, I don't really want to go any faster down wet descents than we already do. But I guess I don't have like a super strong opinion on them either way. I mean, I think, to be honest, I think the industry will dictate a lot of what we do. And I just hope that the rules of the UCI just keep the rider's safety in mind a bit with that. Like, obviously, we have to work with the bike industry, and they, you know, are often the sponsors and the ones paying the bills. But I think just keeping the riders' livelihoods in mind when we make decisions on that stuff is also important.
What would you say the toughest day of your professional career has been?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I would say, you know, a lot of people would think, I guess, that it's going to be like some super hard mountain day or something like that. But honestly, I don't know if I could put my finger on any one day, but it's probably more when you just have like a really shit day. You know, like sometimes like you crash or you just totally mess something up. Like, you know, the team's supposed to commit to doing something at some point and you're just totally not there. And then you get back on the bus and everyone knows you're not there. You knew you weren't there, that kind of thing. I wouldn't say it's so much like a physical difficulty type of thing, more than like there's just some bad days out there.
My question is about your perspective as a rider on the sort of, if you like, disagreement between ASO and the UCI. Mm-hmm. Over the duration of licenses. Is there a view that you're sort of happy to talk about, or if not, maybe what's the general view within the peloton on...
In terms of like duration of World Tour licenses?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing that, you know, 1 year or 3 years, 3 years would be better for, you know, attracting the bigger sponsors, whereas right. 1 year tends to sort of promote a sort of promotion relegation kind of aspect.
Right. So I think I'm not the most up to speed on all of that, but I guess I tend to think that anything that we can do to kind of create a bit more job stability and stability for the sponsors in cycling is a good thing. You know, we're a lot of times, I think, lacking in real sponsorships in cycling. I mean, you look at a lot of teams like BMC, Tinkoff, you know, a lot of these teams are more or less a guy with a lot of money who is into cycling and it's kind of a fun project for him. But the thing is that it kind of shows almost a lack of value in true sponsorship in cycling. And also it's dangerous in that, you know, you look at now Tinkoff is maybe going away this year. It's like that guy who has this more or less toy can get tired of that at any point in time. So I think anything where we can kind of establish that it's a valid investment is a good thing. And if that means longer licenses and you know, greater confidence, because if you're a team manager, you want to be able to sell to a sponsor, you know, yes, we are going to be in the World Tour for the next few years for sure, for sure we're going to do the Tour de France. They want, you know, the biggest viewership they can get. And when that's shaky, then that doesn't help any of us, you know, and it trickles down to the riders in that you look even like this current rider market in this year with Tinkoff potentially folding, with IM going away. Bahrain looks like it's coming in. Maybe Bora is stepping up to the World Tour level, but it's all a bit unsure. Any time where, you know, like the worst case scenario is when you have teams fold and guys are still under contract and there's all these free riders floating around. Because if you're out of contract, it's like, how do you sell yourself if you're, you know, maybe more of a domestique, lower level rider to a team when they can get somebody of the same caliber as yourself basically for free from a team that's just folded? And it really kind of wrecks the job market. And I think for cycling stability in the long term, and I think even from like a clean sport perspective, that also is really important, having that stability. So, I mean, I know this is a very roundabout answer, but yeah, I think longer licenses are probably a good thing.
Yeah, you were appallingly underpaid for your audio diary. And
hasn't been paid anything yet.
I'm still waiting on that.
We're all here tonight. It's all free. Beer's free. Is it fair to say that money doesn't motivate you?
After the earlier revelation about why he joined Team Sky, I'm not sure about that.
I can't say that I've ever thought in, for example, in the Giro, I never thought in the breakaway, if I win this stage of the Giro, then I collect that bonus for winning the stage. Like, that's never really what's crossed my mind. I wouldn't say it's really too much of a motivator. But the flip side of that is, for sure, you see riders who there's definitely an upswing in motivation and performance when it comes to contract time, and a definite downswing after that contract signed. So I think it depends a little bit on the rider, but personally, no. I think I'm pretty motivated year round, and I think there's riders that probably would be best off on a very short 1 year contract leash. And then there's other riders that maybe that added stress of having short contracts is actually counterproductive for them. I'm generally.
It's quite funny because, you know, it jars with some people's, what they, the ideals they project onto the sport, that some guys are motivated by money. But it is a professional sport. I remember my colleague Daniel Freeb, trying for a long time to get an interview with Andreas Klöden, and eventually the press office just said, look, Daniel, he's not going to do the interview. What you've got to understand about Klöden is he is only doing this for money. And, you know, I think that is a reality for some guys, which, again, for fans of the sport who look at these guys and think, wow, they're living the dream, it's quite shocking.
Right. And I would say, though, that one thing you definitely see is guys that are older. You know, once they get in maybe their mid-30s or so, I think a lot of those guys, it's gotten to the point where they're just doing it for the money. Because, I mean, to be honest, a lot of them have invested almost their whole life into cycling. And I think a lot of times they get to that point where, you know, they're not so far off from retirement, but they have no idea what they're going to do next. So it's like, well, I could just keep riding a bike and this is everything I know. So yeah, I guess it's kind of all over the board, I think.
Yeah.
When you talk about retirement, do you ever start to think now about what you're going to do? I mean, I know it's quite a long way down the line, but what you think you're going to do then?
Honestly, I think...
Podcasting.
Yeah. Podcasting. Honestly, I kind of think about that all the time. But more just like... Yeah, sort of as I was saying, like, I've invested a lot in this. I think probably maybe more so than any other, especially for Americans, you know, like, you're moving to Europe, you're taking on a lot, to do this, and it can be easy to get to the end and it's like, you're so far down this road that you don't know what to do next. And yeah, so I, thought about it, but I don't know what I'm going to do. I could see going to school. Like, for some reason, I kind of want to be a doctor. So I've thought about doing that or running, like, a small business. I don't know. Honestly, I just want to get to the end and then do what I... Like, right now, I do what I want to do. I don't really feel like I work. This is what I want to do, and I live my dream. And, I mean, yeah, for sure, there's days that suck, but for the most part, it's pretty good. And whenever I'm done, if I can keep doing what I want to do, then I think that's...
I mean, I joked earlier, but you did seem to enjoy yourself in the final week at the Giro. You did seem to genuinely be enjoying yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, most days I really love it. I mean... There's definitely days that are, like, I remember in Swiss a week or two ago, I think it was stage 6, maybe. It was the day that I rode for Andrew, and G and TJ and those guys were dropped on the last climb. And I remember the descent before the last climb. It was right around 0 degrees, raining, sleet. It might have even been snowing. And we heard on the radio that visibility was down to about 100 meters, and so you couldn't see anything. And I just stopped at the top, and I put on everything I had. I went down the descent. I had a base layer, jersey.
Please don't mention Castelli clothing in here.
Yeah, this is not a sponsor plug. Base layer, jersey, hat, and musette that I stuffed under my jersey, a gabba, and 2 rain jackets. And I actually hit the last climb wearing all of that.
And Walter saw you and said, I thought we told you not to put on weight.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so we're going down this descent. You can't see anything. Foggy. It's freezing. So it was like open range cattle. And I couldn't actually see the cows, but you could hear them mooing. And they were out on the road, and the police motorbikes. I saw one of the police motorbikes stopped on the side of the road, and this policeman, like, visibly trying to restrain this cow from coming onto the descent. And it's just like, this is insane. I don't know what I'm doing out here, but.
Any other questions? One right at the back there.
Who's the most favorite rider in the peloton?
My most favorite?
Yeah.
Ooh. I'm actually a big Thibaut Pinot fan. I like his name. I've decided that if I ever have a son or a dog, it's going to be named Thibaut. But aside from his name, I actually kind of like that he was such a terrible descender for a while. Like, it's kind of an interesting story. And, you know, that I think Mark Matteo took him out on a racetrack and had him drive cars around fast, and hopefully that would, like, cure him of his descending fear.
Classical music as well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of like that about him.
Do you know him? Do you know him at all?
No, I've never spoken a word to him.
You just admire him from a distance.
Yeah, yeah.
You're plucking up the courage to go and speak to him one day.
Yeah, one of these days I'll say something.
Something to think about if we ever see Joe and Thibaut in a break together. any more? I think there were a couple of questions here.
How did you find moving from America to Europe? How did you find the European riders took to you as American?
Well, the riders were fine. I think I was a bit of a knob in the bunch the first year because I'm not the best bike handler my Peloton skills aren't the best now, but I think at least I'm not as annoying as I was before. You know, I think especially there was a lot of gaps that I opened in year one. But the move to Europe itself, in terms of relocating to being based in Nice, it's interesting to look back at it now because now I like it there. And I'm sort of indifferent to whether I'm there or in the States. I mean, home is always home, but, a lot of times I opt to be in Nice when I don't have to be there. But if the first year I hated it, it was terrible. I got to basically April of that first year on Sky, and I had completely cracked. And I called the team and told them that I asked if I could be taken off the race program and just go home for a bit because I needed a bit of a reset. And they let me go back. And then I don't know if they know this, but I was meant to get a visa to live in France because I was there illegally the first year, and it was at the I'm not so far from Washington D.C. where I'm from, so that was the consulate that I would go to get it done, and like maybe 3 days before I was supposed to go back to Europe, I was so traumatized by being in Europe that I called the team, and there was no chance my visa was going to be done. I knew it was going to be like another 6 months. But I just told him, like, oh, yeah, my visa, like, I think if I can stay in the U.S. for another week or two, then my visa will be done, and I'll come back, and I'll be all legit. Even though it was, like, flying in, it was, like, the day before the next race I was supposed to do. And I'm sure they saw right through it, but I did it, and that's, like, how much I didn't want to come back to Europe is anything I could do just to stay in the States a bit longer. I did it. But now I'm pretty comfortable there, and I like it, and I'm happy, so...
Are you legal now?
I'm legal.
How are you finding the coffee in London?
It's good. I don't know if you listened to my podcast from the Giro, but I'm a bit of a coffee... I guess I'm a coffee snob. Yeah, it's good. Actually, I had a coffee over at the other Rafa Cafe this afternoon, and I have to say it was really excellent. There's a good coffee scene in London, and I've heard... I've not yet explored, but I've heard East London is kind of the hipster coffee central.
Epicenter.
Yeah.
Fitting a treat there. Bar Italian Soho as well.
Oh, I was there actually. They've got maybe Cavs jersey inside. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, Matt Rabin took me over there.
Any other questions? Should we maybe got time for a few more? Yeah, there's one over there. Oh, sorry. Sorry, yeah, sorry.
So it's 2020, you're lining up, you know, you're thinking I've got the Giro in like so many months time, and your team manager says to you, okay, well, to win the Giro, you know, we've got a budget because, you know, we're really back up here. You can sign any three riders in the peloton to help you win the Giro. Who is it?
Okay. That's a really good question. I'm going to say Kiryienka. Because he's just a machine, and he can do everything. And he can ride the flat. He can position you at the front, whatever. Kiryienka, Matt Heyman. I was.
He'll be 52 at the time.
Yeah, yeah. We'll find him in the geriatric ward. I was teammates with Matt at Sky my first 2 years. And if I, to be honest, if I was a team manager and I was looking for a director to mentor young riders, I think the first guy I would sign is Matt Heyman. I remember at Sky, there were days in stage races where there wasn't too much going on. And he would come up to me and say, Joe, you're just going to stay with me all day. Just stay on my wheel and I'm going to tell you everything that's going on. We're going to be where we need to be when we need to be there. And I'll just look after you and help you out. And so he's a great teacher. And I think he's a really good road captain. He's got a good head on his shoulders. So we got Kiri, Heyman, and...
You're leaving a lot for yourself to do in the mountains here.
I guess then probably my partner in crime, Ian Boswell. That way I've got a good roommate and
you wouldn't maybe... be sharing a room with Kiryienka, would you, for conversation?
I did share a room with Kiryienka once. It was pretty quiet. But here's the thing. You know, he's everybody calls him RoboCop, but it's not everything you think, because I did Bayern Rundfahrt in 2014, and I was roommates with Kiri, and he doesn't speak. I don't know if he speaks any English, but we were in this German hotel room. And he's the bed across from me, giggling about something. He's looking at his laptop, and he just can't stop laughing about it. And I'm like sort of intrigued as to what he's laughing about. And nothing needs to be said because I'm sort of wondering, and he knows that I'm wondering. And he turns his computer around, and he's just watching cat videos on YouTube. He's just like, "Are you serious?"
Never be able to look at Kiryienka in the same way again.
You know, he's also got, it might be like a miniature poodle or something. Serious. Like he carries it around in a dog bag. True story.
Oh, brilliant. Next time we see Kirianka on the front of the bunch, you know, that stony face. Yeah. Just think of him watching cat videos. Fantastic. I think there was another question over here as well.
So you talk about your training rides of like big GC riders. If there's a mechanical, can any one of them fix it?
To be honest, it seems like the higher caliber the rider, the more inept they are at fixing their broken bike. Some guys are pretty resourceful, but I actually got a call off TJ this, it must have been February, because he had a flat tire and then put a new tube in. And you know, like, it's sometimes a bit hard to get the tube in without pinching it on the rim. And he had done that twice and gone through two tubes. And I had to, I was actually out on a ride and I kind of ignored his phone call, but he was trying to call me to get him to come pick him up. And I think he called a taxi. He was like up on Col de Torini and got picked up by a taxi to come home. So I'd say there's a pretty big spread in wrenching skills in the pro peloton.
Any other questions at all?
With weight being such an issue, especially being a climber, have you ever kind of thought about following the same steps as Lizzie Armistead and your other American, is it Dave Zabriskie, and going vegan?
No. Yeah, for sure. Especially being a climber, weight is always a big thing. And but no, I haven't thought about going vegan. I like eating steak and eggs and milk and whatever else. And to be honest, I think it'd be a little bit hard to get everything you need doing what we do if you're, because you're limiting. I mean, there's a lot of foods you can't eat if you're vegan. So it seems like it's just easier to have it. I think a lot of times people ask what we eat and, you know, what's special about our diet, but for the most part, it's pretty normal, just more of everything.
What is your racing weight?
Around 65 kilos. I actually bulked up a fair bit this year.
You were bulking up over the winter, weren't you?
Yeah, I got up to almost 70.
What's your bench?
I don't know if I can even bench the bar, man.
But you, I read on Twitter last week, you wear 28-inch waist.
Yes,
jeans.
It's true.
Yeah. And yeah. How long?
36.
Must be quite difficult to find them.
You gotta go, probably East London. I've heard there's a lot of hipsters here. I mean, this is probably the place for me to go shopping.
I think there was a question over here.
So, have you been invited yet to the Nippo Vidi Infantini Christmas party, or not just yet?
I wasn't aware of that.
I think that's a reference to your comments about that team on the
podcast. Ah, yes. They're a bit, they are. yeah, I mean, okay, I understand, you know, in the Grand Tours, there's always a few wildcard invites, and Damiano Cunego was dead set on taking the KOM jersey at the Giro this year. And to be fair, teams like that have to race a bit differently than the World Tour teams, because a lot of times they don't have a guy that can stay in the front with the best GC guys. They maybe don't have a sprinter that can win stages. So it's like, well, how do you get something out of the Giro? You have to race a bit opportunistically. And I think even for Cunego, he knew that once they got to the real mountains in week three, that he maybe wasn't going to be able to stay with the best guys that are there in those breakaways. So they were looking for any chance they could to take points. And the first week of the Giro, it's like every day Cunego was not in the break. And the break would go, and there'd be KOM points up for grabs at 50K in. And every day, Nipo would get on the front and bring the break back. And also almost every day, they would bring the break back, it would all kick off again, and they still wouldn't have anybody in the break. And, I mean, it can be easy when you're on a World Tour team to be on a bit of a high horse, like, oh, what are these guys doing? you know, they don't have the right to do that or whatever. And yeah, for sure, it's a little bit annoying because, you know, once a good breakaway goes, most of the peloton's pretty happy it's gone, and we just want to chill out and ride steady, and then we race again at the end. But yeah, they definitely had a bit of a reputation in the Giro for being a little bit annoying.
So we've got time for one final question.
Make it a good one.
Matt Rabin was promising a question earlier, but he's gone very quiet.
Joe, who is your least favourite rider to be in a breakaway with, and why?
Well, you guys might have seen this in the Giro. If not, I was also in the breakaway with him in Tour de Suisse, and he got the better of me. He won a stage. But what's his name?
Atapuma.
Oh my God. He doesn't pull in breakaways. He doesn't pull through, which, okay, it's fine. If you're not going to pull through in the break, then that's fine. Just sit on the back and be happy to sit on the back. But he doesn't pull through. But then when he gets to the front, he just attacks. And they're like the most vicious it's like the most vicious 50-kilogram Colombian acceleration on an uphill you've ever seen. And I remember being stage 20 of the Giro. I was third on the day, and I was in the break with Atapuma that day. And he was doing the same thing where he would sit on, and then occasionally he'd go to the front and just launch off the front and cause chaos in the breakaway. And looking at it now, it kind of killed both of us, because we got to the final climb going up Col de Lombard, and I know all the roads super well because it's close to where I am in Nice, and the bottom of the climb's quite steep, and then it levels off, and it's usually a headwind. So I was thinking, okay, if I'm going to win this stage, I think I'm the strongest climber in this break, but if I'm going to win this stage, it's got to be by me being strong and riding hard, not by... if it turns into us jumping around at the end and kind of like a game of chess, then it's not advantageous for me. So Visconti starts riding in the bottom of the climb. I attack. Atapuma comes with me, but he won't pull. And to be fair, I think it was another lesson learned in that I showed that I was the strongest guy, and he knew that I was probably stronger than him, so he's not going to pull with me. But the whole rest of the climb, I would pull and then kind of swing off, and then he would just attack. And it would kill me because I'm not a super punchy rider, and it was just super annoying. And there were some words exchanged. It was heated. And we had dropped everyone. But then it turns into this game, and we're so pissed off at each other and yelling at each other and playing this game that then... 3K from the top, we've been playing so many games that now Terramai and Congert have come back, and we're kind of looking around. Visconti's there, and Terramai just kind of, he's there for a bit, and then he just kind of rides past us, and I'm looking at Atapuma because I'm, you know, preoccupied with him, and he's looking at me, and Visconti's got Valverde coming up behind, so he's not supposed to do anything, and all of a sudden Terramai has 30 seconds. It's 2K from the top of the climb, and I'm like, well, I just won this, or just lost this stage because, you know, here we're goofing around. So, I mean, it was super frustrating, and I was really annoyed. But that said, I think it was another learning point in that it can be tempting when you feel good and when you're pretty confident you're the strongest guy to sort of show that you're the strongest guy. I think once I had attacked, the thing to do was to just keep riding, because it wasn't yet headwind and it was steep enough that it doesn't really matter if he's on my wheel. So it's like, okay, it'd be nice if he would pull, but if you're on an 8% climb and it's not headwind yet, then it's sort of irrelevant as to whether he's behind or not. And I would have been better off just continuing to ride, and maybe he eventually would have been dropped. But before even that, I think... just playing a bit more possum and, you know, sort of following, because if we get to then 2K from the top, then you can sort of start to play those games. But if you show that super early, then no one's willing, like nobody wants to be in the breakaway with a guy that everyone's pretty confident is stronger than them. So you just have to be careful in showing your cards. And yeah, we actually had a bit of a rematch at Tour de Suisse, and he ended up winning that stage, but maybe he'll come to the Vuelta and we can do battle again.
Get your revenge eventually. Well, thanks very much. I think he's a very engaging, eloquent talker, Joe. He's been great on the podcast this year, and it's great that you've come over here and done this. I think we'll be looking at the O2 next time, or
perfect
Wembley Stadium.
Can we sell it out in 45 minutes again at the O2?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think everyone's enjoyed it. We've probably gone on longer than we intended to go on, but thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you.